If you want to get your Bibles and turn to James chapter 3 is where we're going to pick up our study of this book this morning. James chapter 3, we got down through verse 12 last time, and I realized yesterday, I think it was, that I thought I had three more classes this quarter, but I only have two. I've got this week and next week, and then I'm gone 2 weeks from today, so we've got to finish the book of James between today and next Sunday. So if you've got confidence that we can finish more than two chapters in 2 weeks, then you've got more confidence than I do. But we are going to we're going to give it our best shot. The book of James is a very practical book that we have that we can immediately put into practice in our lives. We spent last week looking at those first 12 verses, which I think is one of the more practical sections in the book, namely because it's talking about something that we all struggle with, and that's our tongue. And the responsibility that we have as God's children to tame our tongue, to get it under control. He starts the chapter in verse 1 in a way that he picks up that discussion we're going to see in verse 13. But he starts in chapter 3 and verse 1, saying, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." We've got to be careful how we use our tongue, especially in matters of teaching. We need to make sure that our tongues are being used faithfully and in a way that would be pleasing to God. And then he talked about the struggles that we have in gaining control of it. But he ended that section, we looked at it last week, in verse 10, saying, "Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so." We need to control those things that come forth from our lips and strive in every way to make sure that they are those things that are well-pleasing in the eyes of God. Look at verse 13. We'll pick up there this morning. "Who is wise and understanding among you?" Remember the context. I think he's going back and addressing these teachers again. Who is wise and understanding among you? How would the world answer that question? Who is wise among us? How's our society going to answer that question? The educated. Is the way that society is going to answer that question a bit different than the way that God might answer that question? Who is wise and understanding among you? Here's the person, verse 13. "Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom." Don? As Don says, the wise and the educated among us today are those who are proclaiming and advocating that there is no God. Who does God say is wise and understanding? It's the one who lets his good conduct be shown. And it's the one through this good conduct that shows through his works that they're done in the meekness of wisdom. God takes wisdom and God takes obedience and he ties them together. And God says if somebody's going to show themselves forth to be wise, it's not just going to be in what they say. It's going to be in what they say, but it's also going to be in what they do. Their good works are going to show forth, but are these going to be boastful works? We've talked about these works when we looked at chapter 2. Are these going to be boastful works where you proclaim not just with your lips, but with your attitude and with your obedience? Are these going to be things that you're exalting yourself? No, these things are done in the meekness of wisdom, not in some arrogant form, not in some haughty way. And that whole discussion that we're starting here carries all the way through chapter 4 to talk about being humble, to talk about being meek. But if you have, look at verse 14, "But if you have bitter envy and selfishness," or self-seeking, or selfish ambition, I don't know what words you might have there depending on your translation. "If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts." Does that sound like anybody we know? Does that sound like everybody we know? Who's envious? Not just who's envious of others, but have bitter envy. Is that something we struggle with? You know, we look at those who are wealthy. We look at those who have, and here we are, perhaps those who have not, and we're envious of what others have. Is there something wrong with that? Something wrong with being envious? Notice this is not just being envious, but is bitter envy. Not just envious of what they have, but you're bitter about the very fact that they have. Bitter envy and selfish ambition, self-seeking. He says, those who have that, better be careful. Do not exalt yourself. Do not boast and lie against the truth. This kind of wisdom with bitter envy and self-seeking, this does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. What does that say about the society that we're living in? Do we live in a society that's envious? Do we live in a society that's self-seeking? Do we live in a society that's boasting against the truth, that is lying against the truth? Do we live in a society that's not concerned about the truth, but would rather twist and turn it to their own use? God says that kind of wisdom is not, if it doesn't come from above, well, then where does it come from? I mean, that kind of wisdom, he says, does not descend from above. Well, where does it come from if it's not coming from above? If it's not coming from above, then it must be coming from below. That wisdom doesn't come from above. What kind of wisdom is this? He says this is the kind of wisdom that is earthly. That's the origin. It's not heavenly, it's earthly. It started here on earth. It's sensual. That's its motivation. It's all about fulfilling selfish pleasures. It's demonic. It's devilish. I don't know if there's a better way to describe the world and the wisdom of the world than how God just described it. For where envy, verse 16, and self-seeking exist, there's confusion, and every evil thing is there. Is God the author of confusion? 1 Corinthians 14 says that God is not the author of confusion. So where did this confusion come from? Where did all of this evil come from? It didn't come from above. And if it didn't come from above, then it must have come from below. Do you think that the devil is at work in these things that are being discussed here? Do you think the devil is at work in this bitter envy? Do you think the devil's at work in self-seeking? Do you think the devil's at work in people boasting and lying against the truth? Do you think the devil's at work in our society? Puffing people up to where they believe that they are higher than God, to the where they believe that there is no God, but if there was a God, that they are higher than that God. You put that in this context. Who is wise and understanding among you? It's not those people. We have a responsibility as teachers to make sure that we ourselves are not exalting ourselves, but exalting God. But look at verse 17. Instead of that wisdom that is earthly, sensual, and demonic, the wisdom that is from above. Who's given us this? Where does this wisdom come from? Here's heavenly wisdom. Here's the wisdom that comes from God. Remember how this book started. If any of you, in James chapter 1 and verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him do what? Let him ask of God. Tie it right into James chapter 3 and verse 17. The wisdom that is from above. How do we get this wisdom? It's from God. The only way we can get this wisdom is from Him. He's the source. He's the origin. We need to ask of God. The wisdom that is from above is first pure. Here's a wisdom that is uncontaminated. It's holy, pure, and good. It's peaceable. The wisdom that comes from God is peaceable. The wisdom that comes from God is gentle. I want you to think about the contrast that's being drawn here. You've got the wisdom that's from the earth that is sensual, that is demonic, that is all about self and self-seeking and bitter envy. But the wisdom that comes from above, the wisdom that's going to dictate how our words, put in the context of the tongue, what we speak, the wisdom that's going to guide our attitudes and guide our actions is pure. That's first. It's then peaceable. How much, make this personal. How much emphasis do we give to purity? How much emphasis do you give to that which is pure? It's peaceable. How much emphasis do you give to peace? Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." How much emphasis do you give to having peace? The wisdom that's from above is gentle. What does that mean? Does that mean you're a pushover? Does being gentle mean that you don't have a spine? You're just a jellyfish? What does it mean if you're gentle? Mickey?
It means you practice self-control.
Okay. It doesn't mean you're spineless. It means that you practice self-control. Tie this in. Tie the word gentle in verse 17 with the word meekness in verse 13. This is a sense of strength, but it's realizing that it needs to be one who is under control, who has a patience about him, a humble patience about him, somebody who's fair. The next word in the New King James is somebody who is willing to yield. I think New American Standard might have the word reasonable there. Somebody who listens, who is willing to listen, somebody who is reasonable in what they hear, and someone who, once they've listened to something, once in their gentleness, in their patience, in their fairness, in their reasonableness, once they've heard something, they'd even be willing to yield and to change if they saw that that was necessary. That's the wisdom that comes from above. Pure, peaceable, gentle, reasonable, or ready to hear, willing to yield, full of mercy. Are you and I full of mercy? Full of mercy, full of good fruits, who acts without partiality. We talked about that at the beginning of chapter 2 and how difficult sometimes it is for us to act without partiality, to do things in a way that we don't favor some people over others. You know, you've got people who are your favorites. You've got people who are in your inner circle who you give a little more favoritism to than others. Do you? We've got to be careful with that. The wisdom that comes from above is without that. James 2 and verse 9 says, if you show partiality, if you show favoritism towards anyone, then you sin. That wisdom that's from above, it doesn't have any partiality to it. It doesn't have any, and the last thing in verse 17 is that it's without hypocrisy. It's not fake. It's not putting on one face for one group and then changing it and putting on another face for another group. It's not play acting. It's not trying to deceive. It's not practicing any deception. It is sincere. It is true. And it is open. That's the wisdom that's from above. Now the fruit of righteousness. Remember, we're full of good fruits in verse 17. The fruit of righteousness is sown. Think about the imagery here. Where does righteousness come from? What is righteousness? Right doing. So, right doing, righteousness, doing that which is right, where does it come from? It's sown in peace by those who make peace. Good deeds are going to come forth from a seed that's planted in righteousness, from right doing. Where is the emphasis of your life and my life? Is our emphasis on that which is earthly or sensual? Is our emphasis on that which is self-seeking? I need to fulfill my needs, my desires, my lusts, my pleasures. Is our life, does it look at others with envy? All of that is wisdom that doesn't come from above. Or are we more concerned about that which is pure and peaceable and gentle and reasonable and true? Is that where we are? Concerned about doing that which is right in a way that is peaceful in every way. It's that section, I wish we had more time to spend there, but the contrast between heavenly wisdom and demonic wisdom is something that ought to make us look inside our own lives, inside our own hearts, to see where we are. Look in chapter 4. Now, remember that when James and the other Bible writers, when they wrote these books we have in the Bible, they didn't write with these, they didn't put the chapters in. James didn't come to the end of that and say, okay, that's 18 verses, that's long enough, let me put another chapter in here. Chapters and verses were added hundreds of years later. And so this is one continuous letter. No doubt it has different sections, as all the letters of the New Testament do. And no doubt, you know, he probably wrote maybe in some paragraph form like you and I. You know, you and I don't write in chapters and verses, but we write in paragraphs. So perhaps he wrote in paragraph form and starts a lot of those paragraphs with the phrase, my brethren or my beloved, as you read this book. But when you come to chapters, when you can, just ignore some of the chapter divisions, because sometimes we get to a new chapter and we think, oh, this is a whole new ballgame. You know, this is a whole new subject. And it's not always the case. Sometimes in the Bible it is, but it's not always the case that you've moved into a different subject, because he's been talking about this wisdom that comes from above and contrasting it with the wisdom that is earthly and sensual and demonic. Now look in chapter 4. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Yeah, he certainly changed topics, didn't he? Because now he's talking about Afghanistan, and he's talking about Iraq, and he's talking about... Is that the kind of wars he's talking about? Where do wars and fights come from among you? Well, that's not what he's talking about. The application would be there. But I don't think he's concerned about the World War I or World War II. That's not what he's... Where do wars and fights come from among you? He's not talking to the world. He's talking to a group of Christians. And to this group of Christians, he says, hey, Christians, where are these wars and fights coming from that are among you? Do Christians ever have wars? Fights? Contentions? Do Christians ever get upset with each other? Do whole churches, congregations... Do they ever get feathers ruffled and have quarrels? That's another word you might have there instead of the word fight. You might have the word quarrels or the word contentions there. Does this ever happen among brethren? I wish it wasn't the case, but it does. So James says, where does that come from? Now, if you go back to the last six verses, ignoring that chapter division, if you go back to the last six verses, where would wars and fights come from? Would they come from the wisdom that is pure and peaceable and gentle and willing to yield and without hypocrisy and without partiality? Is that where wars and fights would come from? If that's the wisdom that characterizes the people of God, how would they ever have wars and fights? If your life is characterized by purity and peaceableness and gentleness and reasonableness, you're going to be willing to yield, or willing to listen, and when necessary willing to yield, but willing to listen and willing to work things out. But where do these wars and these fights come from? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure, that war in your members. Does it come from heavenly wisdom? Uh-uh. This is that wisdom that is earthly. And God says that these contentions, these quarrels, these when you're getting upset and that there's problems within the church, guess where these troubles are coming from within the church? It's coming from you having to fulfill your desires. It's coming from you having to have your way. Do they not come from your desires for pleasure, whether that be for money, whether that be for power, whether that be for whatever it might be, these pleasures that war in your members? Could it be possible that James is talking about here the individual? Could this also be said to an individual Christian? Where do the wars and fights come from inside you? Where do those come from? Is there a war? Is there a fight going on inside of a Christian sometimes? A war and a fight between doing right and doing wrong? War and a fight between following after the ways of God and following after the ways of the world? Where does that come from? What's the source of those wars and those fights? Same thing. Our desires for pleasures that war within our members. This is not just something that impacts an entire congregation. It's something that impacts the individual. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, to abstain from every fleshly lust that wars against your soul. Same terminology. So there's warring within our souls, and then warring even between us that is caused by our desires for things, our desires for pleasures. Look at verse 2. He says, you lust, and that's not limited. When we think of the word lust, we think of sexual lust, and that would be included here, but it's not limited to that. This is, you lust, you want, you desire, you envy, you crave, you have to have. But he says, you lust for things you don't have. You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and you cannot obtain. You have all of these improper desires. Guess what they're leading to? Guess what all of these improper desires are propelling you towards? Fights and wars. Contentions, leading you towards these constant quarrelings with each other. Yet you do not have, the end of verse 2, you do not have because you do not ask. You do not have because you do not ask. So if I would just ask God for that new car, then He would give it to me, right? I mean, that's what I'm lusting after. That's what I'm looking for. If I would just ask God for that 52-inch screen TV, He'd just give it to me because that's what He says, right? You do not have because you do not ask. Is there such a thing as unanswered prayers? Yes, we talked about that in here. Sometimes there are those prayers that we think God does not answer, although the answer itself may be no. And sometimes when we're told no, do we like that? When you were a kid and your parents told you no, did you say, hey, that's great, I love it when you say no? You don't like that, do you? That's not very pleasant. But is there also such a thing as unasked prayers? You do not have because you do not ask. What does God want us to do? God wants us to rely on Him, to depend on Him. He wants us to desire, but is this talking about desiring the right things or the wrong things? Carol? Well, it could be. You do not have, the end of verse 2 says, because you do not ask. So we need to be those who ask. We need to be those who talk to God. Yet, he says, you ask, verse 3, You keep on asking. These are in the present tense here. You keep on asking and do not receive because you ask. What word do you have after the word ask?
Amiss.
What does that mean? You ask amiss. Did you miss it? You missed it. What is it? You ask for the wrong things? In the wrong way? With the wrong motives. You got all three of them. All right? Man, that's exactly what I was looking for. And you got them in the right order. That's impressive. Do we need to ask God for the right things? Yes. Do we need to ask in the right way? Do we need to ask with the right motives? Is it possible that I could ask God for the right things in the right way, but not ask Him with the right motive? If I do that, I am asking amiss. I'm asking wrongly. I'm asking evilly. I'm asking wickedly. I'm not asking properly if I don't ask with the right motives. Right things, right way, right motives. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. Why? What's wrong with my motives? That you may spend it, waste it, squander it, spend it on your what? On your pleasures. What did verse 1 say? Where do these wars and fights come from among you? Don't they come from your desires for pleasures? And now verse 3, you're asking for these things that you might spend it on your pleasures. If our focus in life is on the things of this world, if our focus in this life is on the cares, the riches, and the pleasures of this world, is God going to give us what we ask? No. Look at verse 4. Verse 4 is one of the strongest verses in all of the Bible. The New King James, the Old King James and the New King James, both have the word adulterers and adulteresses. If you have New American Standard, American Standard, ESV, another translation, you won't have the word adulterers, you will only have the word adulteresses. James is writing to a group of Christians, and he says in chapter 4 and verse 4, he calls them adulteresses. Why does he call them adulteresses? Okay. Adulteresses. Saying that to a group of Christians. Does that mean that they were all physically an adulteress? Does that mean that they were all physically committing fornication? I don't believe this is physical here. It's spiritual. There's nothing about the context that would indicate this to be physical. He's been talking about their desire to fulfill their pleasures and their desires in life, and that's not limited to sexual. That covers all of the cares and the riches and the pleasures of life. So he turns to these Christians after talking to them about the difference between heavenly wisdom and worldly wisdom. After saying, where do these wars and contentions and quarrels come from? They come because you want to fulfill your pleasure. So he says, adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Adulteresses. If you go back and you read the Old Testament, frequently in the Old Testament, God's people were condemned for committing adultery. They were frequently condemned for practicing harlotry. Now, sometimes that was in a physical sense, but a lot of times it was talking about it in a spiritual sense. When you read, for instance, in the Old Testament, the book of Hosea, I don't know when the last time was that you read, studied, looked at the book of Hosea. Hosea was a prophet of God, married to a woman, yes, a woman named Gomer, all right? Wasn't a man named Gomer, it was a woman named Gomer, and his last name was not Pyle. It was It was Gomer, Mrs. Hosea. Married to a woman named Gomer. What do we know about Gomer, the woman, married to Hosea? Was she a good lady? She was a harlot. She went out and had children with other men. She went out and was sleeping with other men. In Hosea chapter 3, God tells Hosea, you go and you get her and you love again this woman who is committing harlotry, committing adultery. Why do we have the story? Why do we have a prophet named Hosea? Why do we have a knowledge? You know, we don't have this kind of knowledge about Isaiah. We don't have this kind of knowledge about Micah. We don't have this kind of intimate knowledge about any of the other prophets. Why do we have it about Hosea? Because God used Hosea and what was happening in a physical way between Hosea and his unfaithful wife Gomer. He used it in the book of Hosea to lift it up. It was like a parable, an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. He used it like a parable to say, that's exactly what God's people are doing to him. Gomer is out committing harlotry and adultery against Hosea. Israel is out committing harlotry and adultery against God. Israel was depicted, the Jews in the Old Testament were depicted in Isaiah, in Hosea, in Psalms, in various places as being married to God. Don't you think about that? The Jews in the Old Testament were depicted as being married to God. So if they're married to God and then they go and worship idols, what were they doing? They were committing spiritual harlotry. They were committing spiritual adultery. Why? Because they're married to God. And when you're married to someone, you have committed yourself to them, have you not? To be faithful. If you're unfaithful to God and you go and you worship other gods, you worship other idols. In the Old Testament, they were committing harlotry, committing adultery. Come to the New Testament. Do we have anything parallel to that in the New Testament? We're not Jews, we're Christians. As Christians, not in a physical sense, but in a spiritual sense, are we married to anyone? Romans chapter 7, verses 3 and 4 indicate that Christians are married to Christ. He's the bridegroom. The church is known as the bride of Christ. Christians are in the church. Christians, the individuals, are married to Christ as well as the entire body. The entire bride is married to Christ. And so if Christians are married, we have committed ourselves unto Christ. What happens if we break that vow? What happens if we're supposed to be serving God and serving Christ and being faithful, but what happens if we go and allow the cares and the riches and the pleasures of this life? What if we allow that to become the focus? What have we done? Are we worshiping an idol? Well, in effect, we are. And when we take our devotion in life and take that devotion away from devotion to Christ and we devote it to this world, we become an adulteress. And that's what James is saying. James is saying to these Christians who would become unfaithful to their vow, to their commitment in marriage to Christ, to God, do you not know, you adulteresses, that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Can you be a friend of the world and be a friend of God at the same time? Can you walk down the path with the world and can you walk down a path with God at the same time? It can't be done. You've got to choose. Isn't that what Joshua said? Choose you this day whom you will serve. Joshua said, you cannot serve the gods of this land where your fathers dwell, and you cannot serve Jehovah God at the same time. And that's what Jesus said. No man can serve two masters. Friendship with the world. If I want more than anything else to be accepted by the world, If I want more than anything else to enjoy the things that the world has to offer, I make myself. That's what the end of the verse says. I do it. I make a choice. And my choice is I make myself an enemy of God. I think this is one of the strongest verses in all of the Bible. That I can be considered in the eyes of God as an adulteress when I allow my not just my actions, but even my desires for friendship with the world to creep in. The word friendship here comes from a similar word where we get the you know, phileo love, Philadelphia, brotherly love. Comes from that same root word. Well, we're allowing ourselves to love the world and to be loved by the world more than we love God and to be loved by God. We've become unfaithful to God. And if we want to be a friend of the world, we make ourselves an enemy of God. Do you think that the Scripture says in vain, Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? That's one of the more difficult verses in all of the book. And I wish we had time to talk about it. I personally believe that that spirit there should be a lowercase spirit and not a uppercase spirit. I don't think this is talking about the Holy Spirit yearning jealously. In the context, chapter 3, he had just talked about us having bitter envy and jealousy and self-seeking in our hearts. It seems in the context that would be talking about our human spirit, that it's our human spirit who's in us and constantly yearning jealously, covetously for other things. But don't you know, verse 6, that God gives more grace. I want to stop there and spend the last 20 seconds that I have of class, right, Nathaniel? The last 20 seconds, we can talk about verse 4. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. How do I fix that? How do I fix being an enemy of God? Because is anybody in here perfect? Is anybody in here never going to stray into that friendship with the world scene? Every one of us is going to have parts of our life that stray in that direction. So what am I? Am I hopeless then? Am I dead? You know, if I become an enemy of God in that sense, am I lost forever? What does verse 6 say? God gives more grace. How much grace do you need? How much grace do you need to fix the sins and the struggles and the problems that you have in your life? You think you need a lot? Does God have enough for you? It doesn't just say that God gives grace. That'd be enough. But He gives more grace. God has more grace and will give more grace than you and I need, you and I could ever want. That's the God that we serve, to put it in the context of all of this, and that's the wisdom that we need to have, is the wisdom that comes from above. Because it will bless us, and God will forgive us. He resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. We'll pick up there next week and do our best to finish the book.